It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farm to table means different things to different people, but many would agree that restaurants and their chefs have led the way on our farm to table journey. Chefs might say that they have been led by their own customers, who have shown a preference for food with a story, all the way back to the farm, the farmer, unique varieties or breeds, production practices, and overall sustainability. In this episode of Farm to Table Talk, we are joined at the table by Greg Drescher, the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Industry Leadership at the Culinary Institute of America, to explore what farm to table means in the culinary world and the trends that change menus. What is farm to table?
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about a little bit of the history here, because now, you know, most people's favorite restaurant is either explicitly farm to table or has some sort of farm to table halo to it, a place you can count on getting local produce and so forth. But there was a time going back maybe 30 years ago, with the exception of one or two restaurants, certainly Chez Panisse was an early leader, when sort of the ideal was being able to get things that were out of season or better, shipped in from Europe. It was that sense of it was more exotic and more special the further away it was. And people had kind of lost track of, you know, being in touch with the farms in their local area. And so it evolved over time. Certainly California has been on the absolute forefront of that. I can remember spending time in New York in the early 90s when the notion of farm to table wasn't really there, other than the Green Market in New York City. And then, of course, now it's very much of a national trend.
Let's talk about this trend about being national. So across the country, there's not a region that stands out more than others. They all have farm to table pretty much. And I know you cover all over the United States, all over the world, actually. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. All areas have kind of gotten into farm to table now.
I think so. Not every restaurant, not every sector of the food service or restaurant industry, it's more work, right? It's easier to deal with a produce vendor that you just tell them what you want and they deliver the produce, some of which could be coming locally, some of which could be coming from very far away. And so if you want to really build relationships with local farms, you know, I'm thinking of a chef like Rick Bayless in Chicago, for instance, with Frontera and his whole collection of restaurants. I mean, he's worked diligently over the years to have, you know, connections with local growers to the point where he provides grants to local growers if they need to expand in order to develop that relationship. So it's not just, and you know, Alice Waters and many, many chefs have said this along the way, it can't be just a one-way street. You know, if you want local growers to supply special things to your restaurant, then you have to make commitments to them because they have to plant. You know, it's a very different world. You know, if a chef wants to change the menu for next week, you can do it on a dime in a small independent restaurant. You know, a farmer that plants something in April or May probably still growing that crop in May, June, July, and August.
It strikes me, though, that it's a two-way street in a way, because I also hear of chefs saying that they ask the farmer what he's going to have for them or she's going to have for them, and that they sometimes have to just adjust their menu and saying, well, this is what the farmer has that he says is really good this week, and so that's what we're going to feature.
Right. Right. No, and that's been a great learning curve for chefs, and I think they have absorbed that very well. The other thing about farm to table is that, you know, just as chefs have learned about seasonality and what's coming in and going out of season, it's also been a great flavor education for chefs, because, you know, whereas maybe more farmers in the past, more producers, you know, we're selling into the commodity market, and ultimately, you know, by the time it gets to, let's say, your local supermarket or through the food service distribution system, it's hard to value flavor in a certain way, because who knows who grew it, and it's hard to trace that all the way through. But if you're having a direct conversation between the chef and the farmer, and the chef says, you know, how can I get more flavor in those tomatoes? Or maybe a farmer is growing a small amount of some crop he's experimenting with. It's like, well, I would pay more for that, or I like that a lot. And so there's a more immediate feedback loop between the chefs, who, after all, are trained to be flavor experts, and farmers who can grow anything as long as there's a market there. And I think that's been a really healthy dialogue, if you will.
The Culinary Institute of America trains chefs. Are you starting to train them about communications? Because it sounds like this is an important step, not just cooking and not just preparing something delicious, but also figuring out maybe how they can have a better relationship with their supplier.
Right. No, absolutely. And Farm to Table is an important part of all three of our U.S. campuses. Our main campus in New York, we're right in the Hudson Valley. We have gorgeous gardens there. At our Napa Valley campus, we've got a farm actually right across the street, as well as a huge herb garden. In Texas, we've got great connections with local growers. We actually have a farm-to-table concentration in California, and so the chefs that are there...
What does that mean? Is it like a major?
It's like the equivalent of a major for our bachelor's students. And so there, the students can... Actually, they work on the farm with the farm manager and so forth, and they have a sense of being able to predict when the crops are going to come and how they need to adjust. And so they build their menus at the restaurant there at Greystone up from those, you know, those crops and that planning the farm.
So who gets to write this? I mean, when you do descriptions, I've seen some of these farm-to-table restaurants, and they're famous for having blackboards because they're changing things every day. And some others, I can tell they're printing something every morning because it's got, this is our menu today. It would seem like they have need to have somebody that's able to write on their staffs.
Right. No, and everybody has a slightly different take on that. And I think one of the things that, you know, I was always amused, probably many of your listeners remember the Portlandia episode where the guy goes to great length. He's trying to decide on what to order, and he ends up getting up out of the restaurant and going to the chicken farm to eat the chicken, right? So I think sometimes chefs overdo this as well. You know, there's just way too much information oversharing on the menu. But, you know, along the way, we found out what's that sort of enough information to pique the interest of the diner and to certainly be transparent and to announce that, you know, we have a new crop of, you know, whether it's blackberries or a seasonal something else. But it's interesting to see, you know, sort of the different take the different chefs follow on that.
So these chefs can have a relationship with a farmer. But they also can have like a food hub that's pooling from several farmers. But I believe the large distributors now are also offering that. So that if you have a small chain of restaurants, that I believe you can be pretty specific about having origin of different farms. And the distributors are feeling that they can no longer just have a commodity product. They have to offer these choices as well. Is that right?
Well, I think that's right. And it's interesting to see how some of this is scaling or attempting to scale over time. Because, you know, if it's ultimately 100 or 200 or 500 or 1,000 restaurants in the U.S. that are doing this, and the rest of the food industry, food service industry is undisturbed, it's less interesting, right? So there was a wonderful interview with Steve Case, AOL fame, a year or two ago, you know, who's come in with a major investment in Sweetgreens, the chain Sweetgreens. And he was talking about, you know, how do you get involved with a chain restaurant, a multi-unit restaurant, you know, with the farm-to-table concept. And of course, coming out of the IT world, he said, really, it's just this is an information issue. And so it's manageable, it's solvable, right? And so that's really interesting because for the longest time we've heard from the chain guys, it's like, well, that's fine for year one restaurant, but you know, we can't do that. So it's great to see these innovations that are coming up. And you're also seeing this in the, you know, in the college and university market where you've got, you know, you're feeding 10, 20, 30, 40,000 kids every day. I know Harvard, for instance, we do a lot of work with Harvard. And, you know, they're kind of Yale, they're contracting with local growers, in some cases buying squash and freezing the squash for the winter, just like you would for, you know, an individual restaurant.
You know, another thing that I find curious is that the emphasis evolved from local. But it seems that if you can go back and vouch for a farm, even if it's coming from some distance away, we grow many products out here in California that they don't grow in other parts of the country. And so that's one example. If you're going to have oranges on the menu, it's not going to be in Cincinnati unless you ship them in from California. But a company, say a brand, say, well, say like Grimway, they have carrots. I see them connecting too and participating in it, even if their products have been shipped 1,000 miles to be able to the restaurant. Greg, I'm wondering, does this mean that it's kind of drifting or bridging into not just local only, but identifying the origin and the farmer's story that connects with the menu?
I think You know, it's at some point, farm to table is kind of a shorthand for a collection of values and trends, in that, you know, chefs increasingly and their customers care about the quality of the product. They want to know how it was produced. They want to know what are the values of the producer, the farmer. And I think, you know, certainly chefs understand that they can get, you know, it's one thing to be farm to table in the middle of the summer. It's another thing to be farm to table, you know, all year round, depending on what part of the country you are. So one of the challenges has been, you know, how do I promote local farms at one part of the year and then kind of change my story at another part of the year? And so I think in many respects, it's chefs and operators, you know, sort of moving into an expanded story, which is about supporting better agriculture, supporting farmers that care about flavor and production practices, favoring local, but knowing that at some point you're going to have to bring in product from all over. It'd be easier to say, I either completely buy from within 100 miles of my restaurant all year round, or I don't do any of that. But people have found their way, and I think it's, you know, it's interesting to see a lot of the big California produce suppliers, you know, farmers and so forth, now also looking at regional hubs and seeing what they can do in the upper Midwest and so forth. And it will be interesting to watch that trend to see how far that can go.
You know, I was just speaking to somebody who's an executive with one of the largest supermarket chains. And they told me something I had never heard before, and that is that they've had some stores that they've closed that they're converting to farms, that they are now creating a hydroponic operation with internal lights and all of the other things they need to produce produce in the Midwest. I'm curious, have you heard of that happening with restaurants producing hydroponics or aquaponics to supply themselves?
Well, I think that's something certainly that restaurants are looking at. And we do an annual program with the MIT Media Lab called Rethink Food, coming up actually in November. And they have an open ag initiative there at MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Mass. And they're very much focused on sort of the future of agriculture, looking at, you know, producing, you know, indoor technically driven agriculture. You know, we actually last year had a presentation, interesting sort of provocative presentation from the founder of the Media Lab, who said, look, in the future, 20, 30 years from now, you know, we won't have to ship food around the world, because you'll be able to almost create food computers, if you will, that will, if you say, you know, I really, you know, like the peaches from Georgia, or I like the flavor of the citrus from somewhere in the Mediterranean, he said, we can program that DNA into local agriculture and do anything you want locally. So who knows where all this is going in the future? You know, I think it's people pursuing multiple tracks at the same time. They're pursuing flavor. They're pursuing a sense of, you know, transparency and the values around production. And then people are very practical. They're also pursuing sort of technological and operational solutions.
Freshness kind of goes to the extreme, local freshness, when you go to Asia. And I know you've had a facility, I think you have an operation in Singapore. I remember years ago going to China, and we go to some areas where you go in the restaurant and you get up and go pick out the fish that you wanted them to prepare, that was tanks all around the restaurant area. I thought, my, that's going about as far as it can. But then I got to another area in China where I ordered the chicken, and I happened to walk back to find another room, and I saw them literally bringing in the chicken that was flapping its wings, and it was going to be as fresh as you could stand, I think, pretty soon. It is interesting to see how this is shifting and changing and allowing people to dig the information and say, this is exactly what I want. When training chefs, how do you stay in front of it? I mean, how do you look at these trends and be able to see and suggest to them what's happening next? What's maybe the next wave of farm to table, or what do they care about as far as like antibiotics free and cage free and so forth? How do you capture that?
A lifetime of watching trends, you have a sense about things, but we have a pretty big global network that we stay in touch with across culinary world. We have a partnership with the Harvard School of Public Health that helps us stay on top of some of the health and wellness trends, sustainability trends, and so forth. And you just look to, you know, what's the vanguard looking at in the world of chefs. Coming back to the world of chefs, we're working with a new foundation out of Europe called the EAT Foundation. They're pursuing a very similar initiative is our Menus of Change initiative, which is looking at the integration of health and sustainability and sort of deliciousness, if you will, going forward. And we teamed up and we launched a website that actually your listeners can check out. It's called plantforwardglobal50.org, plantforwardglobal50, or you can just Google that. And it's 50 of the best chefs in the world that are sort of favoring plant-forward in their cooking, which could be vegetarian or vegan recipes, but more often than not, it's just chefs that have elevated vegetables and plant-forward cooking on their menus. And Washington Post did a great feature article on it, and the headline was the 50 best places in the world to eat your vegetables. One of the chefs that we featured had a great quote, Amanda Cohen, who has one of the sort of the hot vegetarian restaurant in New York City now called Dirt Candy, which is a great name. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, she said, anybody can cook meat. She said, vegetables are best left to the professionals. and so that's a little bit of an interesting insight, because it's true that we have, part of the challenge in the world of chefs is that, you know, vegetables and other plant-based ingredients have often been the stepchild of the protein, right? You know, you think mm-hmm. about going into a restaurant, sure. Somebody is going to order a bottle of wine, and you go around the table and you say, what are you going to have? You're going to have the duck, I'm going to have the lamb, I'm going to have... Nobody said I'm going to have the carrots,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so part of that is, you know, what you value, you tend to get better at, right? Mm-hmm. What you put your attention on tends to grow value. And so I think part of the switch that's going on now, and you see this in the top restaurants, is chefs, and this ties into the farm-to-table movement, chefs paying more attention to... you know, getting the best possible raw materials, produce and other, you know, plant-based ingredients, and then figuring out what to do with them in a way that elevates them in terms of being special, also elevates them in terms of what you can charge for, because that's another piece of the puzzle here. If you can only charge so much for, you know, a salad, let's say, that's one thing, and, you know, the differential with what you might charge for lobster or steak or what have you. But boy, you go to, you know, the French Laundry, and of course that's all prefixed, but you know, you go to the French Laundry and you have something that comes out of Thomas Keller's garden, and it's transformative. It's so fabulous, right? So it, you know, that's a part of culinary education in the future, as well as thinking about how to work with products that we've traditionally thought of as less expensive, as sort of, you know, the supporting actors on the menu, and making them the stars.
You know, when you talk about even pairing with vegetables, I remember somewhere I was at, they were talking about pairings, and you may know the answer to this, but when you ask somebody what goes best with asparagus, you know what the answer is? Nothing.
Nothing. Okay, there we go.
It's the only vegetable that doesn't pair.
I thought you were going to say hollandaise.
Right, well, that's probably true. If you did the hollandaise on it, then I think you can probably have a nice Pinot with it.
But
if you just have the plain asparagus, there's not a good wine with it, apparently. Yeah. But somebody might prove me wrong on that fact. Look ahead at the interest that you see when you talk to chefs and they come, and you get a sense for what's coming down the road. What seems to be the kind of issues that they are really curious about, that they see coming or they worry might be coming?
Well, I would say that sort of the difference between flavor and culinary trends that will keep them up to date on kind of the food piece that connects them with their customer, and then all the other issues that come along with food, from health issues to agricultural practices to climate change. I mean, I think climate change is going to be a huge issue going forward for the chef and restaurant community. If you look at the climate accord in, you know, in Paris and so forth, and general climate change issues, you know, everybody points to the energy sector, but food and agriculture contributes a fair amount to the greenhouse gas challenges and so forth. So, you know, that's going to be something that people pay attention to increasingly. The other thing, though, that I come back to, having had the benefit of a lot of travel over my career, is, you know, the opportunity to bring a few things together. If you look at sort of some of these traditional diets around the world, like the Mediterranean diet or traditional food ways out of Latin America or Asia, you know, beautiful ways in which plants, vegetables, other plant-based proteins were more center of the plate. Meat was there. Other animal products were there, but they were there generally as a supporting actor. And then, of course, on Sundays and feast days and so forth, you know, you knock yourself out with whatever you want. I'd hate to be a lamb at Easter in Greece. That, I think, is a pathway going forward. And if you look at to give the example of a family, let's say a mother in rural Thailand feeding their family, part of it is they're not trying to restrict the amount of meat or say, serve more vegetables. I need to serve my kids more vegetables. It's just going to the market, seeing what's there and what can I afford. Right. And so, you have this delicious repertoire of Thai dishes that evolved over centuries that leverage small amounts of meat and fish and other animal-based proteins that are traditionally expensive into these just absolutely gorgeous, creations. So I think that as the world, one of the great gifts of technology has been this sort of shrinking of world cultures and what seemed like, long ago, it's like, why would I pay attention to what's going on, on the other side of the world? I'll never go there. I don't know anything about it. And now it seems like, if you pick up any magazine or newspaper worth its salt, they're talking about restaurant openings in Mumbai and the latest thing in Istanbul and so forth. And so we're much more interconnected. And as a result, I think we're just at the beginning stages of sort of pulling back the layers of the onion and figuring out, what's there in terms of these literally centuries-old food traditions that we have a lot to learn from.
Oh, that's exciting. And then if anybody's on social media, if they've got, Facebook or Instagram, you can't open mind without seeing somebody that's traveled somewhere and they've got a picture up. I was just thinking if we could ever figure out how to digitize aromas, it'd be the whole thing because people are off and they're seeing this. And I think the other thing that I find exciting about what you've just described is that maybe getting somewhere takes money, but a lot of what you're describing is not terribly expensive. It's street food in these different areas and where people have been able to come up with wonderful flavors using what they have, and it's not necessarily terribly expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever I'm talking about health or environmental issues and so forth, you want to make sure that it doesn't sound like an elitist solution coming from the world of chefs, right? Back to some of these cultures from traditional, more, plant-forward cooking from Asia to Latin America and so forth, people were feeding their families on pennies a day, right? It's gotten a little more expensive in many parts of the world now, but still, that's, definitely a budget play there, the opportunity. If you can, I think about travels in North Africa and the ubiquity of chickpeas, for instance, over there. Mm-hmm. And just gorgeous preparations and not very expensive.
Boy, it's an exciting picture that you're painting here. And if people would like to know more about the Culinary Institute of America and some of the programs and activities that you have, where do they go?
Best thing is just Google the Culinary Institute of America, and you'll get to, we have a couple of different websites. Also on food issues, menusofchange.org is a great site, which is in partnership with the Harvard School of Public Health.
And let's go back to that one site you mentioned earlier, too, 50-something.
Oh, plantforwardglobal50.org.
Yeah. That, I'm going to look that one up myself.
Yeah.
Well, hey, listen, Greg Drescher, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk.
Great. Thanks, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.